Welcome to podcast number 2 of HIV 101. You got this. From fear to empowerment. Finally integrating HIV care into your practice. So this is the podcast series that is leading things off for our big keynote speaker series in 2024 about integrating HIV into your primary care. And this is episode 2 of 3, our little mini series. And for you clinicians out there listening, this is a really important episode. This is one of those episodes, you know, sometimes we as clinicians, we want to jump to, oh, just what's the nitty gritty? What labs am I ordering? How often am I testing? How do I put someone on PrEP? What the heck is, you know, these brand name medications that my patients living with HIV are on? We want to jump to all of that, right? But I think that this might be the most important of the 3 podcasts in this series, because we are hearing from 2 incredible activists in the HIV community, 2 individuals who are living with HIV, and we need to hear their stories. We need to hear what their life is like living with HIV now versus when they were diagnosed. We need to hear how they represent communities that have been marginalized and sort of intentionally left out the HIV conversation. And we need to hear their perspective on how we can do better as clinicians, and so that you can get it right from the very beginning when you decide to integrate HIV care into your primary practice. You're going to get it right from jump, and you're going to get it right from the beginning because of listening to voices like these 2 individuals. So I'm not even going to, I had a whole like bio thing presented, prepared, and I'm not even going to do it, but I am going to allow them to introduce themselves. So Raif Darazi and Shadon McCants, welcome to the show. Welcome to the podcast. So I think Raif, I'm going to start with you. Just, you know, tell the folks listening just a little bit about yourself real quick, and then we'll give Shadon a chance, and then we'll just get right into it.
Sure. So I am a HIV advocate, content creator. I was diagnosed with AIDS in 2012. I'm undetectable. I'm living well. I am co-chair on a community advisory board for the HOPE Collaboratory, which seeks to work on HIV cure research. So I'm giving feedback as a community representative. I'm also, in my personal life, a competitive natural physique bodybuilder, which has been an important component of my journey going from an AIDS diagnosis to reclaiming my health and sharing all those wonderful things on social media is my passion.
And has a big, lovely, wonderful social media presence. And I will allow Raif and Shadon at the end to tell us about their social media and where y'all can find them. But I will tell you, as someone who works in HIV care and you know, tries to stay on top of the research and the science, a lot of it I get from Raif. Because I'm like, Raif has got literally world-class experts on their YouTube channel and really bringing us all in and saying, okay, here's what the research looks like. Here's, you know, the latest and greatest. And oh, by the way, here's what's going on with, you know, questions that our patients ask. Like, is this supplement really going to interact with my medications and things like that? So Raif, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. And as someone not in the HIV research science clinical space, as a community member, ChatGPT, let me tell you, has been my best friend in translating a lot of that information.
Look at you. That we got it. The AI, that'll be our podcast series in 2025. Right. Oh my gosh. AI in medicine. Shadon McCants. Shadon and I had the pleasure of, we officially met for the first time in Atlanta, right? It was Atlanta.
Yes.
We are both, so as most of you know, I am a clinician ambassador for the CDC's Let's Stop HIV Together campaign. And so it is part of my job doing that work to help educate the public and specifically clinicians about HIV care and prevention. Shadon is a community ambassador. And so someone in the community with a really powerful voice, an incredibly loyal following. I mean, Shadon is one of those people that Shadon is like, I need y'all to wake up and have a good day. And every single person that listens to Shadon is gonna wake up and have a good day. And so we need Shadon's voice as a community ambassador for the CDC, but I don't wanna take too much more of your thunder, Shadon. Tell the folks who you are.
Hey guys, my name is Shadon McCants. I am Yes, a beautiful, bold Black woman who's been living with HIV for 28 years come December 19th of this year. I was diagnosed at the tender age of 17, a senior in high school in 1995. Currently, I am an advocate. I believe that we can and we will achieve an end to the epidemic, but we must do that together. And a huge part of that is definitely looking at the disparities and realizing also health equity is a birthright. Professionally, mm-hmm. I am a licensed professional counselor, but I love to I've coined myself the healologist because I am very intentional about making sure that individuals actually do their work to heal. We collectively have experienced a lot of trauma, wounding, disappointments, hurt and pain, and especially individuals who are living with an HIV diagnosis. And so I'm very intentional about doing that work and helping individuals to do their work to heal so that they can live their best authentic lives. Because what we know is oftentimes people are with a diagnosis, they are just in a space of sometimes just existing, and then they get to that live, but I want them to also thrive. And so that's just a little bit about me. And like Dr. Simmons said, I am an ambassador for the CDC Let's Stop HIV Together campaign. This is my third term doing that. I am excited about that opportunity. I am the face of I Am a Champion, Hope for the Future for Theratechnologies, and just some other little things. But like I said, my heart and my passion is really showing up for individuals, giving them a face and a voice that is of hope, love, and just, hey, we got this. So that's just a little bit about me. And I'm excited to be here. And hopefully you guys leave with something that leaves you inspired to continue to do your work, but to do it from a different space that looks at all of us, and especially those of us that are living with HIV, from the first letter. And that's a human perspective.
I love that part, the human perspective. And Shadon, I'm gonna keep going with you, because there is something very human, something very powerful about your story when you were diagnosed and how young you were. And in particular, you had a better experience than a lot of folks, but you also kind of had to guide some of these clinicians into what you were looking for. Tell us more.
So as I was stating, guys, I was diagnosed at the age of 17. I was a senior in high school. And I tell people that year I had what I call as a teenager the forever cold. And so I had gotten sick in October. And so when I say sick, it was just kind of like what we know the symptoms of HIV. But at that time, I just thought it was a cold. I ended up contracting meningitis. And when I contracted meningitis, yes, it was in December. I'll never forget. I was sitting at my father's house and I was dizzy and lightheaded and almost basically I felt like I might have passed out. And so I went to the hospital and they sure enough were like, yeah, there's a meningitis outbreak and that's what your case is. Wanted to do treatment. Normally it was a bacterial, you know, treatment. You get to go home. No big deal. Well, within 24 hours later, I was in the hospital. I tell people I was there for 5 days, probably 5, 6, 7, 8 spinal taps later. They sent me home. Yeah, exactly. And it was devastating, y'all. Even a lot of times when I talk about the spinal taps, I remember yelling and screaming. I remember the pain of how excruciating it was. But I also remember them letting me go home and saying to me, oh, she's fine. She's baseline. She's good. But there was something in my spirit. There was this voice that I knew that something wasn't right. And the reason I can tell people that is because I also have been a young adult. I tell people looking for love in all the wrong places and making some decisions out of and from a very traumatized and hurt place. And so I went back to my practitioner at the time and I told her, I said, test me for HIV. This was literally within probably 24 to 48 hours of getting out of the hospital. And she was like, why? You just left the hospital, and I said, because I need you to. And sure enough, she tested me. Within 2 weeks, I was sitting in the doctor's office with my mother at this time, because at this time, I needed to have my mother, which I can tell people up until that moment, I was able as a teenager to go into the doctor's office, be treated, didn't need an adult with me. But this time I needed my mother. And I sat there with the provider who told me with tears in her eyes, she said, Shadon, you have tested positive for HIV. And what I tell people is that thank God I had something in me that knew I needed to advocate for my own healthcare. Because even then in 1995, and we know what we know, that HIV was white, male, and gay. It wasn't African-American, let alone an African-American young woman, and definitely not a teenager. And so I advocated for myself, and I tested positive for HIV. And within 2 weeks, I was at an IDC clinic with adults. I was my provider. Her name, she doesn't mind me giving it, is Dr. Judith Feinberg. She's an amazing provider. And I was her first adolescent patient. So within 2 weeks, I was at an IDC clinic getting ready to start, at that time, the first medications that were in the market.
Wow. Now, were you able to achieve, you know, what we talk about achieving undetectable, right? Were you able to achieve undetectable fairly quickly? Did you have any sort of like early diagnosis complications, you know, other than obviously the meningitis?
So, you know, Dr. Simmons, I'm going to be very honest, and I'm still in the process right now actively of trying to obtain my medical records from that time because I was told that I was diagnosed with HIV. But what we know now, of course, is that I had meningitis. I do recall them telling me my viral load was probably over 300,000. It was a very high number. And what I remember my doctor, and again, this is 1995, so we're still very new. The medications are very new. It was AZT and 3TC. But I remember her sitting there and telling me, she was like, Shadon, you will not die. I just need you to trust me. And now, of course, what you're talking about, U equals U, was not a thing then. Like then it was just, you go in, you're getting blood work every 3 months, you're taking your medications and all those things. But what I did know, and now hindsight, is that yes, I achieved at that time what undetectable could have looked like very, very soon in. I know within 6 months, she was like very, I remember her saying, your numbers are amazing. You're doing really well. I just need you to keep this up. And I'm like, okay. So what I know,
keep it up.
Exactly. What I know now, yes. What we know to be U equals U, which is undetectable equals untransmittable. I'm sure I achieved a very amazing level of viral suppression at that time. But I also remember being a part of the first studies when they would ask, I remember her saying, well, we just need this number under 10,000. We need this number under 5,000. And I remember that conversation, of course, to now what we know is U equals U.
Which is fantastic. And how powerful too for her to say in that moment, Shadon, you're not going to die, but I need you to trust me. And which is so, I mean, it changes everything, right? That type of outlook can change everything. And I know, Raif, I think about that powerful moment that Shadon had, and knowing your story, because we've sort of previously worked together, but you did not really have powerfully, positively impactful situations like that. What's the story of your diagnosis, Raif?
Well, you know, to be fair, I'll get to it, but there were key people who did reinforce my health in the same way that Shadon experienced. But overall, it was very clunky. I'll put it that way. So for me, I did not have health insurance. I'm living in LA. I'm in a relationship for about three and a half years. So HIV is the furthest thing on my mind. Yes, it pops up because it's always been like a huge fear, just being a gay man, that I'm gonna get HIV and AIDS and die. And even when I came out as gay to my mom, that was like one of the first things she said to me was like, well, you're gonna get HIV and you're gonna die. And there was like jail was somewhere in there, is just the formula she had in her head. And I'm like, I don't know.
Wow.
So it was always like this looming fear, right? But at the same time in my head, I'm like, I'm in a relationship, so I don't have to worry about that. Needless to say, I had been experiencing a number of symptoms that I didn't necessarily string together, but there was one really prominent issue that I was dealing with in my throat. I thought it was strep for a long time. Mm-hmm. I got antibiotics through my boyfriend at the time, through his dad was a doctor in another state. So he just sent a script over and I took it. I healed right away. Everything was good. And then 2-3 weeks later, it came back and it was super painful. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, okay, I have to be seen by somebody because I can't just continue on like this. So I ended up going to the county hospital. I waited, I want to say like 8-9 hours that day to finally see someone. This woman was really great. She was super friendly, nice. We kind of like had a good rapport. We were joking together a little bit and she's like, well, we're going to do a full spectrum of tests just so we can knock things out and then follow up in a few days, come back. I did that, waited another 8-9 hours. I went into her office again, same woman. And this time she was super quiet and almost solemn. And I thought, oh man, she's having a rough day. Like, let me try to cheer her up or something. Right. And I remember her looking at her screen to the side, like didn't even make eye contact with me, looked at her screen, took in a big visual breath, exhale, and then turned to me and said, "You have HIV." And I just remember, like in the movies, when the camera just like zooms and it's like a tunnel vision. I remember that happening and thinking I'm going to be dead in 2 or 3 years and that's it. And I started to break down and cry. She said, "I'm going to give you 10 minutes. Do what you need to do. Call somebody, tell somebody that you care about and share it with them." And I did that. And then she came back and she said, "Okay, we're going to have you come back in a week from now, go to the clinic that is specifically for people living with HIV, and then you'll get more information." So that's pretty much how I was sent out the door.
So to just sort of like hang out for a while, for a week with no questions answered.
Just put all that on pause. And she added as an addendum, you're going to see a lot of really sick people because this is county. So we've got unhoused and we've got people, drug abuse and all that. So, but don't let that deter your perception. That's not your story. I'm like, okay, great. But so I come back a week later.
That's a fair attempt, right? A fair attempt for her to be like, you're going to see some people who are sick. That's maybe not your story. I don't know if she completed that sentence or not, but.
Right. So it happened to be on my 27th birthday, and I remember sitting in the doctor's office, doors wide open, and one of the nurses walks by. He's like 6'2", covered in tats and piercings, really gruff voice, stops. He sees me, like backtracks a couple steps, and he goes, "Hey, you know why you're here, right?" And I'm like, yeah, 'cause I have HIV. And he goes, "Kid, you got way more than that. You got full blown AIDS," and then walks off. At that point, I had resigned myself to kind of face whatever was going to come my way. I was like, come what may at this point, like whatever it is, bring it on. I'll deal with it. And then my actual doctor came in, Dr. Rochelle Rawls.
Before you go there, Rife, did you understand in that moment what he meant? The difference between, because you said, "Oh, I have HIV." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Kid, you got more than that. You got full blown AIDS." Did you understand the difference of what that means in that moment?
I did on a certain level. Like, I had seen Angels in America, and I had seen the progression that those characters made in that story, from being diagnosed to suddenly having Kaposi sarcoma and all these other symptoms and being in the hospital and dying. That was my understanding of what it means to have AIDS. So I'm like, okay, I'm like, a doorstep away from that.
Wow. So I'm sorry, I cannot imagine your emotions in that moment and being told in that way. And your 2012, is that right, Rife?
When you
died, 2012? And how, even Shadon just told us in 1995, right, that her provider at that time was like, "You're not going to die, but stick with me, but trust me." And fast forward, what is that math, 17 years, and what a missed opportunity for both of those providers to have been like, "Hey, you know," he literally could have been like, "Well, kid, you got AIDS, but also you're probably going to be all right." Right. Like that. I really want to just highlight that for the clinicians listening right now, that sometimes think about the two core memories that Shadon and Raif have just shared with us and how influential we are in that, how important we are in that. And so it's not hard, but hope matters, and knowing the science about why someone even with AIDS at that point, with T cells below 250 and viral loads, or like Shadon's was over 300,000, all of those, you got AIDS presenting diseases, things like that, still hopefully for most folks doesn't mean a death sentence. And for us to understand that science is so important. I'm sorry, Raif, I want you to, because you got more story, I want you to keep going, but
please,
I really want to
hammer it home. Exactly. No. So when my doctor came in, you know, she was the voice of reason. She explained everything she told me the same thing that Shadon experienced, that I was going to be fine. She's like, "Trust me, you are going to be perfectly fine. You are going to be able to live your full, long, healthy life. She explained that she had people come in with a CD4 of 1 before, and now they had a CD4 of 1500. So, and at that time, as she's explaining to me, she realized that I, you know, studied musical theater. So she goes, "I want you to sing me Happy Birthday. Let's sing Happy Birthday together." So I'm singing Happy Birthday. Tears are coming down both of our faces. And then the nurse pops back in and he goes, "Oh my God, I didn't know it was your birthday. I'm so sorry." That was just the cap.
That would have changed anything.
Right.
Wow. Oh my God. What a birthday story. And not necessarily the right ways, right? What a birthday story. But also, just like I was saying before, what a blessing to have that. And it was a doctor, it sounds like, right? An MD or DO come in and say to you, "You're going to be okay. You're going to be fine. You're going to live. This is going to be all right." So compare and contrast then what you experienced at that time. And I kind of want to focus on like sort of the first 3 months, we'll do maybe even 6 months to a year, of being in HIV care versus how it is now. And Raif, I'm going to let you keep going. So in that first year after this diagnosis, what was your meds? What was getting in your care? What was lab work? All of that like versus your life with living with HIV in terms of a medical care now.
Okay, yeah. So like I said, the facilities, they were prefaced to me as being kind of run down, kind of scary, a lot of sick people. So that was very much my impression starting out. I was immediately put on medication and antibiotics, and the medication was, I was experiencing lots of side effects, intense side effects, waking up in the middle of the night, almost having hallucinations and brain fog, headaches, to the point where my doctor was like, "Raif, you need to stop drinking because your liver's not looking so good." And I go, "Rochelle, like, I don't drink." And she's like, "Okay, well then it's the medicine, because right now you have the liver of an alcoholic." Wow. And so we had to switch. So that was the initial, although I have to say, in spite of all that, within the first 6 to 9 months, I went from, you know, my AIDS diagnosis to being undetectable and my immune system having rebounded, which is, it's miraculous, really.
Right. Tremendous.
I want to say that the experience now is a lot better. It's still inconsistent though. Instead of going to a clinic that's just for people living with HIV, I'm going to a regular doctor's office where, you know, general population goes, which is great. I had one doctor who's fantastic. I recently had to switch because of health insurance reasons to a new doctor. And I was disappointed because when he greeted me like this and attempted to do an elbow bump.
Explain what this is to the folks who are just listening.
So instead of shaking my hand or even fist bumping, it was the notorious elbow bump, which has become, you know, pretty popular ever since the pandemic, the COVID pandemic. But I really want to stress, especially for the HIV community, the importance of being treated with humanity. And I understand transmission risks of COVID or what have you, but being sensitive specifically to our community is so important. I once had a doctor who early on, when he came in to greet me, removed his glove in front of me and then shook my hand. And I remember just being like taken aback. Like he, like in that one gesture, he completely validated me as a human being first. And so I understand if you're worried about transmission of viruses and colds and whatnot, but that's why there's a sink and soap and sanitizer. And you can do that after I leave the room and take care of your business. But for now, it's about you and I and creating that relationship and that trust.
Especially from a primary care perspective, right? If this is someone who's going to be actively involved in managing your care, particularly hopefully for a long time, right? That's the ideal model for a lot of primary care providers. I think that's something that we don't think about. I've certainly been guilty of the elbow. And it's more, you know, I'm a hospital person generally. Most of my practice is with critical care. So I'm constantly thinking about all of the things that I have touched that I don't want to give to someone else, right? But that's my perspective inside my brain, and how a patient might interpret my elbow dap is important, right? Because we're here to serve. So Shadon, you compare and contrast, if you will, your experience with getting into care at 17, my God, 17 years old, versus what you're experiencing now.
And so it's kind of similar to Raif, is that, so I will say is one of the things is that from the day of diagnosis, I actually had premium health insurance that I've still had up until this day. And so, however, though, because it was still very new in 1995, there was my provider. And because of just, you know, my illness and just where things were, they sent me to, like I said, Dr. Juna Feinberg, who was also what I realized it was Holmes Hospital. And so it was kind of like the county hospital. And for me, same thing. I walked in there and I was like, oh, no. I can't be in here. And it was what we unfortunately were seeing a lot of, which was addiction, which was poverty, which was individuals very sick. And it was scary. It was scary as politically correct could be. Let me just say that, since I know what platform I'm on. But just know, it was literally, and I'm 17, right? And I'm seeing individuals older than me who are, you know, unfortunately not doing well. And so I will say, but again, my doctor, she understood that. She could see how my face was like, I was like, oh yeah, I can't do this. I can't come in here. This is scary to me. This is deafening. Like, you telling me I'm about to live, spirit inside of me telling me I'm a live, but I don't see live here in these in these seats. Actually, I remember one time going into the clinic, and there were officers with inmates in chains in the lobby. I was just like, yeah, this is a lot. And at that time, I'll never forget it. It was the county van and people in chains and shackles. And I was just like, yeah. And so this was, of course, the time too, where I was needing to actually get, I was literally, this is when you had to go to the doctor every 3 months. Every 3 months you were getting labs. Every 3 months you were seeing the provider. You were, you know, sitting with this person, sitting with that person. So now I may go to the doctor. I'll go once a year. Maybe twice for my HIV specific care. And that's just because I am at a space where I undetectable, meaning that my viral load is under less than 20 copies. My CD4 count, now we ain't gonna talk about that because I have my feelings about when it comes to men. Y'all CD4s be high. And mine is still in the sevens and eights. I'm trying to understand where these 1500 numbers is coming from. But that's a whole nother, I digress. But you know, I'm doing really well. And so, and I love that we're having this conversation, because the truth of the matter is that now technically my care can be managed by my primary care provider. I don't necessarily have to see an infectious disease doctor. And so as we're having this conversation, it is very important that, you know, primary care providers really get to have this conversation with us. So that they know how to care for us, because, you know, there is that, you know, I can say I've had experiences with primary care doctors who are I don't want to say uneducated, it's just not their specialty. And so they don't understand the life, the experience of someone living with HIV. And I'm going to be honest, I've been the educator. Because I am an advocate in my care, I am going to have this whole conversation. I'm gonna tell you what's, you know, what research to go after, maybe what other provider to talk to, kind of that kind of thing. To like, yeah, now it's literally managing HIV. It's like diabetes. It's like high blood pressure. It's like a stub on the toe. I don't want to minimize it, because I think if I do that, then people, again, unfortunately, which is something we're struggling with, will continue to not see it as a health emergency, especially for Black and brown bodies. So I don't want to, you know, do that. But I also want you to understand too, that it is manageable, and it's something that you can do with me. We can do it together.
And doing it together, Shadon, is so important. You know, it's the conversation together about labs and this, that CD4 count and viral load and all of that. But it's also the conversation, and I know you're really passionate about this, about your sex life. And dating and marriage and
having kids.
cisgender heterosexual woman, right, having kids, or I guess anyone having kids, right, who is able. And so all of those things. And can you talk to us a little bit? This is your chance. You got a lot of clinicians listening right now, both of you. Shadon, I'm obviously starting with you. What are some of these misconceptions that some clinicians might have that you wish you could like help correct, particularly when it comes to like sex and pleasure and reproduction and all that?
Well, providers, I'd like you to know that I still enjoy having sex, and it's excellent. And good sex, and sex with whoever I want to have it with, right? So mm-hmm. I would really love to have that conversation, because that's really a misconception. That's one of the big ones that I have encountered, and people that I work with and I advocate for and advocate with, is that the providers think that we are out here just once we got this diagnosis that we are not getting ready to have sex, have good sex, pleasurable sex, all the things. And mm-hmm. it's like, baby, hopefully you still doing it, and I can too.
Right.
And because of you equals you, now me and my partner, because I can also be in a serial discordant relationship too. And hopefully for my providers, you know what that is. That means one individual living with and one without. Like, those relationships exist, and they yep. exist with my choice to have sex the way that I want to have it. And in some cases that is condomless sex. So mm-hmm. it's like, and I know some of the providers are like, huh? She actually said that? I did. And I enjoy it. But that's my choice. And that's the choice of me and my partners. And so, and also that pleasure can exist in that relationship. And so that's one of the misconceptions there. Of course, the misconception is about childbirth, is that we know now, when I was diagnosed in 95, there was still a high rate of women who were still... their children were contracting HIV from them. Well, now we're less than 1%. Again, mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, really, really impart, because U equals U, it means just what it says, is that there is what, and I'm a correct and make sure that we say this correctly. There is no rate of transmission. There is no possibility of transmission from sexually, let's say that, make sure we say right. it sexually, from my right. from me to my partner. And so, you know, because sometimes the conversations is, oh, it's less than 1%, or it's less than this. No, the science says, CDC supports, that the rate of transmission is zero when it comes to the sexual pleasure and intimacy between me and my partner. But again, that's as long as I am doing what I need to do. And if you are getting my labs and we're discussing them together, then we both see I'm undetectable. We both see that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm showing up for not only, you know, myself, but my partner and community and the collective. So that's one of the misconceptions. And like I said, the other one about childbirth is that I can have a child. And we know the new science, and this is going to be a new one for you providers, is that the CDC has confirmed that mothers can choose to chest feed. We're going to say chest feed because mm-hmm. everyone is, we understand, so that I'm inclusive, that you can chest sure. feed now, and it's sure. not a crime. And that's something that we can do. So the misconception is that we can't have children, and that, of course, even if we have those children, that we can't chest feed, and we can. And so those are a few. Raif, I know you have a few more. What? I'm going to bounce it to you.
Right. Love it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And also, speaking of U equals U, really defining what it means to be undetectable, as it's been stated, as having under 200 copies per milliliter of blood. A lot of folks are concerned when they have an HIV viral blip. Oh, that means now I'm suddenly at risk of transmitting all of a sudden. And other people will make the argument too that someone could be adherent, but if they have an HIV viral blip, that's not going to protect me. Well, a lot of blips are under 200 copies per milliliter of blood, which is still considered undetectable, which means you still cannot transmit. So we need to be clear about that argument as well. And then I can't speak to childbirth myself, but I can speak to other things outside of sex, since you did so well covering that topic. For example, for me, it was so important to really go after my fitness, my physical fitness. And a lot of healthcare providers they tend to lean on the conservative and rigid side when advising their patients about whether they can be physically active, whether they can go about and do the things they care about, sports, supplements, all of that stuff. For me, I was able to become a competitive, natural, competitive physique bodybuilder. I take whey protein. I take pre-workout. I take BCAAs, creatine daily. And I've done that for years. And my labs support that I'm able to do that and be healthier than I've ever been. That isn't to say that it will be the answer for everyone, but I think that's where it matters that we have this discussion on an individual basis, look at our individual health needs and really address it that way instead of giving blanket statements like no whey protein, never. It's too hard on your kidneys and too hard on your liver. It's just, that's not as true, nearly as true as it used to be when medications were a lot harder on our bodies. So understanding that nuance and really understanding that in order for us to succeed as people living with HIV, we need to address all of our goals and aspirations in life and really have that reinforced by our healthcare providers that we do have permission to go out and seek all those things. That doesn't mean that we just go do it blindly and carelessly, but we can have that conversation and really have that, like you guys were saying, have that back and forth. And this is a journey we're going to walk together and get true medical advice.
A conversation. You both said conversation and or discussion probably half a dozen times. And I think that's so important, right? Just have a conversation. Folks listening who are living with HIV or taking medications to prevent HIV, either way, because there's a lot of conversation about that. Oh, PrEP is so hard on your kidneys, so you can't do X, Y, and Z. Well, we're starting to learn that that's not necessarily the case. Either way, it's about a conversation with your provider, right? And it's about us as providers, clinicians, understanding whole person care, right? Natural bodybuilding is something that makes Raif insanely happy. And so, okay, well, let's figure out how we can make that happen, right? Let's figure out how we can make everyone living with HIV feel comfortable in their bodies and have good sex, because sex is a part of our everything. It's a part of us. And so, you know, if I think clinicians listening, if you take anything away from this, at least podcast two in the series of three, right, is that it's all about a conversation and you're treating a whole person, right? We're so taught often a diagnosis forward, right? We deal with diagnoses first, people second. And specifically when it comes to all humans and all diseases, period, but specifically with something like HIV that carries so much stigma still this day, we need to lead with person forward care, right? Whole person. And you know, I think this whole person approach is part of overall when we talk about how we end the epidemic by 2030. And that feels like an ostentatious goal now, 6 plus or minus years away from that, but we can do that. And I just want to ask both of you, like people living with HIV who are out here in the community and so well educated and really advocating, like what excites you the most, Shadon, about the future of HIV research and care, and in particular about ending this epidemic by 2030?
So, you know, I will say this, that is a very complex question, right? Mm-hmm. Because when we talk about ending the HIV epidemic, there is a complexity there. Sure. And I know it's probably for a whole nother episode, but I really do want to make sure that we put it out there is that, yes, we want to and we can achieve an end to the epidemic. However, we will still have individuals, the 1.2 million in the U.S. and the 40 million globally that are still living with HIV. So
right.
I think one of my hopes is that we make sure that when we're talking about ending the epidemic is that we do talk about what does that look like for those individuals who are still living with HIV, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that we get to the 90-90-90 goals. And for those that are listening, I'm about to take a whole different feat. So I might need y'all the 90% of no new diagnosis, 90% in care, 90% undetectable. And so we can achieve that. I do believe that we can. That's what we will see. But again, we won't do it without the inclusivity of remembering those that are also already living with the diagnosis, right? Mm-hmm. I'm excited about right now the new shift in movement as a Black woman, the inclusivity of African American women, specifically, you know, Blacks. I will say this, cisgendered Black women and my sisters of trans experience, but specifically cis heterosexual Black women, because for so long women have been literally left out of the conversation. But what we know is in the data, you know, if we're going to talk about data, the data definitely shows us where it's, where those that are most impacted, those in the South, those, you know, so I'm excited about, you know, really the inclusivity of African Americans and specifically Black women, in research and, all that is happening. I'm also excited as a long-term survivor. I've been living with HIV for 28 years and I'm in this gap. So I'm not seen as over 50, but 28 years is a long time. So that's over half of my life, right? And so I'm excited about the new conversations and implementations to really, really focus on those of us who are long-term survivors. What does it mean to now live a long, I tell people I slay the runway of my life. Look like to do that? And so I'm excited about that. And I'm excited about just, I think one more thing is just, again, the two things is that we have come a long way with medications to where I now only take one pill a day. I tell people I swallowed and look this good. So I'm excited about that, but I'm also excited because now there's the option of those who are eligible to take an injectable. That is amazing, so that now I don't have to be reminded by a pill, but I can get an injection every month, every 2 months, or what's possibly about to be every 6 months, and I really get to thrive. Those are just a few things that I'm really, really excited about. But I just want to make sure that we don't leave out the, you know, like I said, all of those, that are already living, and what are we going to do for them? So,
right. Yeah. It's very important, and it's important to those of us in the community, sometimes it feels like we say this all the time, like literally the first thing out of my mouth, you know, this recently with World AIDS Day and the media I was doing for that. One of the first things out of my mouth was this disease still disproportionately impacts people of color, still disproportionately impacts queer populations, we have completely left, like you said, primarily cisgender, heterosexual Black women out of the conversation. And guess who's being disproportionately impacted more than anybody else right now? Second, followed second only by cisgender, heterosexual Latina women. So like, right, and our siblings of trans experience, yeah, everyone, right, all of that, that's literally the first thing out of our mouth. So Shadon, I'm so glad that you brought that up, but especially in terms of people living with HIV, when we sort of talk about different modes of care, right, you hinted at some of that with the new injectables, but then even like there's vaccine research going on right now, there's still cure research, which is a little dicey conversation, that's a whole other podcast series, but Raif, I know you have some sort of special, unique involvement in that type of forward-looking and that type of the future of HIV. I really want you to sort of educate us clinicians about what you're doing with that.
So yeah, it's really exciting. The NIH is funding these 10 Martin Delaney collaboratories nationwide, and each collaboratory is a community advisory board, representatives of the community, partnering with research labs for HIV cure. So I've partnered with the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco, the University of Florida Scripps Research, and Weill Cornell Medicine, as well as some labs in Germany, Sao Paulo, Brazil, Uganda, and Thailand. And so they're all working together on different strategies for HIV cure research. And we meet with them on a regular basis, discuss their findings, discuss their research. We provide feedback as community members on things we'd like to see improved, changed, modified, such as person first language. That's a big one always in clinical studies, and making sure there's representation. So it's not just white cisgendered men who are being represented in these clinical studies, but we really expand that. And so I'm excited to be learning so much about HIV cure research. I think there's a lot of amazing things coming down the pipeline, possibilities. It's really being attacked from so many different angles. Mm-hmm. And I am excited and hopeful for the fact that I get to take all this wealth of information that I'm learning from the science community and then relay that to the lay community, people living with HIV, healthcare providers, et cetera, and really help to like translate this really dense, heavy scientific data and information and try my best to put it in a way that's understandable, because I think there's a huge desire and a need for our community to learn. We have a lot of information, HIV 101, which is great. There it's is. Fantastic. It's vital. It's critical. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we have this really heavy, dense science, which is like, essentially, it's a completely different language. And yeah. So really filling that chasm, bridging that gap, and taking people on the journey of HIV 101 to start to introduce new elements like what you were talking about, Shadon, about comorbidities and aging. And so we're not giving this narrative to our patients that's really black and white. Take your medicine, get to undetectable, go out and live your life. That's all you got to worry about. But really the nuance of like, okay, so yes, I'm undetectable, I'm healthy, I'm living my best life, but there are some things that I should be cognizant about, like increased comorbidities, different risk factors that come along with chronic inflammation, and it's nothing to be scared about, and that's where the education comes in. And the more we know and we understand, the more we can empower ourselves and have a sense of autonomy and control of our lives, and the less that we feel like a victim to our disease. But for healthcare providers, it requires you to trust that if you give us more information, it will allow us to make better decisions, and not the fear, which is if we get a little more information, then we're going to run with it and be reckless and careless. For example, if you say you don't have to take your medication every day on the hour, on the minute, on the second in order for it to be effective, there might be a fear that we'll just say, oh, okay, I can be loosey-goosey about my medication. And if I forget tomorrow, oh, well. If you empower us with the knowledge and the education of what it means to be adherent, without the rigidity and the black and white nature of saying it has to be this way, otherwise no go, then we can start to work with that and incorporate that into our lives and routinize things in a way that suits us individually, instead of what I see a lot of as a product of being really rigid in the guidance that the patients are given, is that there's a lot of anxiety, hyper anxiety and concern. Like, for example, I have a community of followers that are like, oh my gosh, like, what if I don't take it within 15 minutes of when I took it yesterday? Or what if I need to change the time of day because I have these side effects and I want to take it in the morning? Maybe that'll be better. How do I do it? Do I need to do it over the course of 6 weeks and slowly change the time by 15 minutes every day? Or like, it's just too much worry. And we know that anxiety contributes to increased risk factors. So it's totally counterproductive. But my theme is just to have a more nuanced conversation. Be willing to educate us as you educate yourselves and learn these things, so that we can kind of, again, go on that journey with you.
Individualize it, right? Like you,
yeah, exactly.
There are, I will say to my fellow clinicians, there may be some folks who are not ready for that type of nuance, or some people whose brains, my brain tends to like some rigidity when it comes to my health, right? I forget my blood pressure medication if it's not the very first thing I do in the morning. But I set up that structure for myself, James Simmons, because that works, and my blood pressure is well managed because I wake up every morning, and before I even talk to my husband, before I roll over, before I pick up my phone, before I do anything, I grab that pill bottle and I pop my one blood pressure medication, off I go about my day. Because that's worked for me, because my conversation with my doctor is, well, why'd you keep forgetting to take your blood pressure medicine, right? And we figured out a whole thing. And so I love that you bring up the individuality of it. Then now you can start to, okay, this person's educated in this, or they're really curious, right? That's always a clue for us to know, great, we can have a more, to your point, Raif, nuanced conversation with our patients and make it individualized. And I cannot think of two better individuals to have had this conversation with all of us and share your stories. Shadon McCants and Raif Durazi, I thank you both so, so much for not only joining us today and sharing your stories and how excited you are about the future and living your lives with HIV now and your stories of diagnoses and how to continue doing this work in the community, but also because of the work that you do in the community. And this podcast is just one of many, 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 many things that both of you continue to do for the community, us as clinicians, for folks living with HIV, for folks preventing HIV, the whole spectrum. So I could go on and on, but I'm droning. I just cannot thank you enough. And for those of y'all listening, thank you again for tuning in to the second of three in our podcast series. HIV 101. Can I be any more excited about it? HIV 101, you got this. From fear to empowerment, finally integrating HIV care into your practice. The podcast series. This was 2 of 3. Stay tuned for 3. Raif actually teed us up really nice for that. There's going to be some really interesting dialogue in there about individualizing medication therapies for folks, labs to check, all the nitty gritty, the stuff that our brains really like as clinicians. We're getting into that in podcast episode 3, so you might as well just keep it rolling and listen to that one. Until then, Shadon, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
So I make it very easy for you guys. Everything is under Shadon McCants, from my YouTube channel to my Instagram, Facebook, email. Everything is Shadon McCants. That is spelled S-H-A-D-A-W-N. M-C-C-A-N-T-S. And that's on Facebook, Instagram, it's I Am Shadon McCants, Twitter is Shadon McCants, all the things. Just reach out to me, stay connected. I'm excited about what this journey looks like.
And I just have to say, on the side, like, incredible fashion, just have to say. All right, if you want to know how to dress. Raif, where can the folks find you?
Yeah, same for me. I got the memo as well. It's my first and last name across all social media, as well as my email.
Excellent. Very good. Shadon McCants and Raif Durazi, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you on the next podcast.